There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening, I'm Brandy Scott. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. We're going to look at Dubai's new vision for the cultural industries, art, music, history, and find out why they matter if you're a business. Plus, I've been down at Emirates Flight Catering, taste testing my way around the place, and I'm going to tell you how you make an omelette taste good at 30,000 feet. But first, speaking of tourism, new data reveals that tourism makes up 11% of the UAE economy. Philip Wooler of research firm STR is going to explain how Dubai is adapting to the new normal of lower hotel rates.
So we asked him, first of all, what are we seeing in terms of occupancy at Dubai hotels?
As far as the Dubai hotel numbers are concerned, we have a year-to-date occupancy of about 73%. So on average, 85,000 rooms are occupied every day in the city. At the same time, in 2014, we had a year-to-date average of 78%, year-to-date as in end of August. But I think with considerably less rooms, and I think that's the important distinction. So if you compare the two, we were selling 65,000 rooms in 2014 and 85,000 rooms in 2019. So the good news is, even though occupancies have dropped, demand for the city is considerably higher and more people are visiting Dubai than ever before.
So it's a good news story. I mean, Dubai's tourism industry over the past 15, 20 years, no question. And we asked him about the future, in particular, the supply of new hotels. We've got a lot of new supply coming on track. What's this going to mean for room rates?
One of the biggest challenges for Dubai has been the extraordinary amount of new supply coming into the city. In the last 4 years, since the end of 2014, another 30,000 rooms have opened in the city. That's 112 hotels. So clearly one of the very big reasons for pressure on the room rates. There is still more to come. There is still appetite for investment. It's still a strong market. It's a different market to where it was. But in terms of pipeline, we could see another 40 to 50 hotels open before the start of the expo in October 2020, which is a considerable amount of hotels adding between 20 and 25,000 rooms to the market.
I suppose for anyone who's been 10, 20 years, you've seen the face of Dubai change. Brand new city, brand new areas of the city. I suspect there's probably no city in the world, maybe Shanghai, but probably not many cities around the world that have changed as much in 20 years as Dubai has. And of course, that's meant changes in every single industry. And we asked Philip how the hotel industry has changed over the last 10 years or so.
I think another way of looking at it is when you annualise the data. In 2009, for example, Dubai had around about 15 million rooms to sell on an annualized basis, so for the full 12 months. We're now in a position where Dubai has 40 million rooms. So you can kind of understand the sheer scale of where Dubai has moved over the last 10 years. And the fact that Dubai still averages occupancies of 73%, particularly when you consider the seasonality, it's a remarkable story. So supply will continue to increase. We probably will hit more like 45 million rooms in the next couple of years before supply will start to level off.
Supply leveling off, but what about the room rates then? How much has that changed?
Average room rate has been more of a challenge. Average room rate has dropped from the peak levels of 2014, where it was averaging about 850 dirhams. $233 to the current average room rate of 544 dirhams, which is about $148. Now, clearly, that's not an ideal situation from an investor point of view, an owner, or even an operator. But for Dubai and the future of Dubai, the very, very high global levels of the average room rate in 2014 had to change. And they had to change to develop a more competitive landscape, particularly when we think of the expo and 25 million visitors coming into the expo and beyond. Then room rates had to fall a little bit. So that's where we are at the moment from an average room rate point of view.
We also asked Philip, what did he forecast for the coming months, and particularly with one of the great events on our horizon, that is Expo 2020 Dubai?
So on that basis, STR is forecasting that room rates and to a lesser extent, occupancies will continue to decline until September, October of next year before seeing some good growth through the expo months of between 10 and 15%.
That is Philip Wooler, the Area Director of Middle East and Africa at STR.
And of course, the good news is for staycationers, isn't it? I mean, is it selfish that I just look at it and what does it mean for me? Does it mean that I can get a good bargain for a weekend? Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
And I think we all do as well. And also in the food and beverage outlets within the hotels as well, getting a good deal. I know people who are working in the events industry. It's easier to negotiate a good deal for a ballroom at the moment because they're just having to work a little bit harder.
How do you get the best deals? I mean, because we all look at, you know, websites now to have a look at. Do you ever ring a hotel and say, listen, come on.
Yep.
You know. What have you got hidden? There must be something you do. You?
I do.
And does it work?
I read a piece by, credit where credit is due, Alice Hayne in The National about a year and a half ago, and she said barter for everything. Bar sort of your groceries at Spinney's.
Not barter, you mean bargain.
Bargain. But yep. She meant, no, sorry, yes, you're right, not barter. But she said basically go in and haggle, even if you would be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. And I was, the day I read her piece, I was buying a swimsuit. In a shop, in a nice shop on Jumeirah Beach Road. Normally, it would not cross my mind to haggle over a swimsuit. And I just said, feeling like a bit of an idiot, is there any chance of a discount? And the woman said, yeah, I can give you 40% off. 40% off. And if I hadn't asked, I would have paid 40% more. And from that, I now, no matter what it is I'm booking, and I have this, I mean, I lived in the UK for a while, so I have that British sort of resident of making a bit of a fool of yourself. Yeah. But I do say, seriously, is that the best you can do? Can you not do me a better deal? And
soup,
I would say
mentality.
50% yeah. of the time people say,
cool.
Oh, okay, then, yeah.
It's certainly a sort of indicator of the market.
I'm not comfortable doing it in the slightest, yeah. But I do it, and I do it with hotels as well.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening, this is Brandy Scott. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap.
We are three once again. The band is back together. Brandy Scott back in the studio. You bunked off yesterday.
I did. I bunked off and I went to the other side of the creek.
Really?
I did.
Deeside?
I did go Deeside and I went Deeside because I was going to the airport.
You were taste testing, weren't you?
No, I was running away from you lot. Yes, I was taste testing. I went behind the scenes with Maxwell Smalley, who's the guy who does all of our filming and our social media and our camera work, in order to have a look at how things worked at Emirates Flight Catering. Got into a conversation with Emirates.
What snacks have you brought us back?
None.
Malcolm, have you seen any evidence of this?
Nothing, and I was expecting them. I think we were promised, in fact.
No snacks for you.
We've been let down badly.
No snacks for you.
I'm guessing there were maybe rules about just slipping a business class meal into your purse and taking it away from Malcolm and Richard.
They confiscated my sweets on the way in metal tins. Malcolm keeps giving me sweets in metal tins. And they took them off me. I wasn't allowed to take them in. I did get them back. But I'm just saying the security is tight. Anywhere that you're near around the airport, the security is exceptionally tight.
Brandy Scott had to wear a hairnet, as did aforementioned Maxwell. Maxwell has a beard, for he is a millennial. He had to wear a beard net. The pictures are on Brandy's social media at Hey Brandy Scott and the Dubai Eye social media.
Oh, we've put them everywhere.
They're
now on. They're now on Dubai Eye's Instagram stories this morning. We've popped them up on the Dubai Eye Facebook page. They're on the Dubai Eye Twitter if you want to go and have a look at what a beard net actually looks like. It did surprise me that Maxwell had to wear a beard net. I thought they were joking when they said it at first and they handed it to him. But I'm going to tell you five things that actually did surprise me going into Emirates Flight Catering that I did not expect.
Number one
was I learnt that it's not actually about the cooking. I thought I would go there and I would sort of find out all these fantastic tips about how you feed, I don't know how many hundred thousand people at 30,000 feet. But the thing that actually makes the entire thing work, it's not about the cooking, it is about the washing up. This is Senior Manager Robert Paulus talking me through the numbers.
If you look at first economy and business class combined, we touch for Emirates alone approximately 3 to 3.5 million pieces of equipment per day.
And by equipment, we mean?
From cutlery to China to trolleys and containers and ovens. In principle, everything that we load on board an aircraft, which is related to the food service, the meal service, has to be washed.
It's a lot of washing up. As you can hear in the background, that was in the washing up area. And I said to him, okay, however many, 3 million knives and forks, who's actually doing the dishes?
On a 24-hour basis, sorting out the dishes, about 800 people. in terms of the actual jobs that people do, it's probably the least attractive. It's the most important one.
And are they actually washing the dishes, or are they going through the world's largest dishwasher?
They're going to the world's largest dishwasher. Every machine is designed to handle a specific type of equipment based on the chemicals that are required. So if you look at glasses, you want them to come out without any water stains and nice and shiny.
So this is better than my dishwasher, is what you're saying?
Definitely, definitely. And we don't wash with water, we wash with steam.
Why steam?
It dries much quicker.
Four things in there I didn't know.
It's huge. And he said this is the nerve centre. I mean, yes, it's all very nice that, you know, elsewhere in the building they're breaking their own bread and all the rest of it. But he said if the dishes don't get washed and turned around in time to go out on another flight, nothing would happen. Forget your cheesecake. This is the bit that makes it all work.
So that was number one, and number two was the number of dishes and the washing machines that are used. What was the third thing that surprised you?
Okay, so the washing area looks industrial and high-tech and on a massive scale, but the second thing that really surprised me was that all of the cooking was a lot more like actual cooking than I expected.
As our main hot kitchen area here, it's broken up into four main sections, so Far Eastern cuisine, Arabic cuisine, continental cuisine, and subcontinent cuisine. We have executive chefs from each of the regions running the areas, so try to get the food as authentic as possible. Japanese chef, Chinese chef, Korean chef, just basically cover all the destinations that we fly to.
And that is James Griffiths. He's one of the big chefs there. In fact, he is the big chef there. I thought it would be quite industrial looking, that things would be coming out of, machines and what have you. They're not. There was a guy flipping pancakes, hundreds and hundreds of tiny pancakes, and he was flipping them. People were grilling lamb chops. People were putting blueberries into fruit salads.
Do you think they specialise? There's one person who just is blueberries into a salad. There's one person who flips omelette. I mean, do they do that all day long, every single day, or do they mix and match?
Well, I hope they mix and match, because the omelettes looked fun to start. The little tiny pancakes looked really fun to start with, but I imagine, 2,000 pancakes, you've probably had enough. But it's all done by nationality, and the nationality is done by where the food is going too. So if you're flying into Germany, that's when you get the sauerkraut and the bratwurst. And they have different chefs, German chefs, Japanese chefs, as you heard James, the vice president of culinary, saying there. They have different chefs for each of the cuisines. And it is effectively, they are making it in the way that you or I would, but in a much larger scale. This is one of the Emirati chefs. This is executive sous chef Saud Al Matrushi, telling me which of his Arabic dishes I need to try next time I'm flying.
Try our machbous. So machbous is a traditional Emirati dish, and it's popular amongst the Middle East and the GCC region.
Do you want to describe it for me?
So machbous is basically rice cooked in chicken or beef or fish broth with Emirati spices and with the protein on the side.
And it's all, and like I said, it all, it's just homemade but bigger. The one exception is that the cakes are cut by a hydro cutter, which is a fierce stream of water that cuts the cakes because it's quicker, it's more accurate, they all come out the same size, there's no wastage. If you think you cut a cake with a knife, you always get a bit of cake left on the knife. Don't get that with water.
It also keeps them moist as well.
It could take your finger off, one of the chefs said to me, really? And he said, yeah, if you put your hand under there, that would actually take your finger off. I was like, yeah. He said, yeah, it's that strong. He said, you wouldn't feel it, actually, for several seconds, because it would be such a clean, fast, hard cut that you wouldn't feel it at all. I was like, thanks.
They cut the cakes with water?
They do. It is this incredibly fast, sharp hydro jet that looks, it's continuous, it looks like a knife, and it's computer programmed as to the shapes. You could cut it out in flowers, you could cut it out in hearts, you could cut it out in squares, do anything. But incredibly dangerous. Yeah. There's a big screen over it, and it won't work unless the screen's down, because it could take your hand off.
Yow.
And so here's the other thing that I didn't expect. Not only is it like proper cooking, not sort of scary industrial ingredients, but the food they use is the same stuff that you're buying in the supermarket. Emirates breaks all its own bread, right? The only exception is the pita bread, which they buy in the Arabic pita bread. They buy the same brand of pita bread as I buy from the supermarket that's next to my flat.
Is that right?
Exactly the same. Plastic bag, yellow and brown on it, if you buy a Pitt Bridge, you'll know which one you mean. Blueberries. Same punnet, same packaging, same company I'm buying my blueberries from. That is
but
how...
they don't say, pay the same price, though.
The same. Well, I bet they don't, because they're going through a lot of blueberries. And that actually is quite important, because I said to them, the guys there counting out the blueberries for the fruit salad, and I said, is it... I mean, does he know it's 8 blueberries per salad? Are you literally counting out 8 blueberries? And they said, no, we weigh them. And I was like, sincerely? They said, yeah, every 8th plate, you'll weigh it, and that's how you know that you've got the right number of blueberries. But it's not because you're being tight on the blueberries. It's because if you were to put 10 blueberries on every second dish, you're going to get halfway through the meals, and it's going to be like, we've run out of blueberries.
And you're going to have... someone pop down to Carrefour?
And you're going to have a... problem. The one thing that is slightly different, and James was saying to me that there is apparently this rumour about powdered eggs, that when you're on an aeroplane, you get powdered eggs. And so he went out of his way to show me that what they actually buy is local eggs that have been decanted into almost a Tetra Pak. So they're fresh eggs, but they're pre-broken outside the facility, made especially for Emirates in these massive Tetra Paks of effectively raw eggs. Egg. And the reason that they do that is to have someone within Emirates breaking every egg would take, and he sat down and done the maths, 24 people working 12 hours a day in order to break all of the eggs that they needed to make their omelettes.
They have professional egg breakers.
So the egg breaking is outsourced, except for poached eggs. So Emirates still does break 4 million eggs a year in order to poach its eggs. And the last thing that surprised me was that we walked, just as we were leaving, we walked down a corridor and we walked past a very long table that one of the staff said to me very quietly, that is the table of shame. This is what's on it. So we're standing here in front of a table of what?
Single-use plastic. So that's all what we're using currently.
And so you've got, forks, containers, plastic bottles...
All variety of containers, whether it's for food or for drinks or for storage. So we are working on removing all of these from our daily consumption use, looking at suppliers for biodegradable or reusable sources to replace them with.
So every single piece of single-use plastic that Emirates uses is on one sample of each on a giant table. In the middle of a hallway that everyone walks down. It's called the Table of Shame, and it's to remind them that this is the stuff they are getting rid of.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. I'm Brandy Scott. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I have been down at the airport. I've been down at Emirates Flight Catering, having a little look behind the scenes to find out how they keep everybody fed and happy, basically, on their flights and how they're using new technology to do so. And I've been speaking to Ravi Nage, who is one of the regional catering managers for Emirates, to find out what you need to think about when you are preparing food for 220,000 meals a day, that is, at 30,000 feet.
Are they the biggest caterer in the world?
I don't know if Emirates is the biggest caterer in the world. I think the wider machinery may be. Funny enough, I was asking about whether or not they had the biggest washing machine, and someone said to me, we kind of have a lot of world's biggest everythings. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When it comes to, I don't know, world's biggest procession of people putting blueberries on a fruit salad, they said there are a lot of things in here that would qualify for sort of a world's biggest certificate. This is Ravi, though, having a chat more, not so much about the records, but more about thinking about the individuals, what they need to think about meal by meal by meal when they are trying to prepare stuff that tastes good when you're flying in what is effectively a very small pressurized metal tube.
High altitude with the air pressure drop and humidity drop, it does make a difference in your taste buds. Things like tomato, acid-based product, do taste very well on board. So they do factor into our menu design, our menu planning. But many of our products are also very heavy in their regional structures. They have lots of spices, lots of flavors built into it. So we actually go for those things, which are really going to elevate the palate. They're going to actually perform very well on board.
So high taste, high spice is good. What's not good? Is there any food that just doesn't work?
Foods which have a lot of fat contents, fried products don't work because they go soggy on board. Things which are more of an a la minute products, fast food, definitely no. Things which actually take a longer time to cook, stews, braising, they really work very well. Very, very well, because by the nature of the product, the more you cook, the better it gets.
And given that the food is chilled down and then reheated on board, what do you do to make sure that it doesn't look like, well, when I take food out of the freezer and reheat it and it goes a bit dry and it looks a bit nasty, how do you keep everything moist?
So we do develop these dishes to be self-contained, so it has the moisture content in the dish itself, plus an added element to give that moisture into that dish. It's things which are actually cooked in their own juices and their own sauces really perform well. So we do take that into account. Dry product also, like a beef tenderloin, which is grilled, a steak, do very well, provided we provide a nice sauce, an accompanying sauce to it.
So what's the big trends that you're following at the moment when it comes to food on board? The people we interview about supermarkets talk about the rise of plant-based food, of vegan diets. How's Emirates addressing this?
One of the biggest trends that we've been following lately is the farm-to-table, things which we actually can procure locally. It's in our DNA to make sure that we actually develop the local market, because there's no point for us to actually go to different markets which we service and not pick up product which is available locally, because that's going to be the most optimal product that's available. So farm to table is big. We are going a lot directions in terms of making sure the healthy food, sustainable food is out there on our menus. We do make a huge deal about it. Of course, we are a Middle Eastern airline, so we do promote the Middle Eastern hospitality, Arabian hospitality on board, with the mezes that we serve, with the Arabic dishes that we have created, a lot of signature Arabic dishes like the majboos, biryanis, we have those on board.
Are you seeing an uptick in people requesting meat-free meals?
Vegan is a third largest special meal. We do provide 18 different special meal categories on board.
What's number one and two?
Number one is child meal. Number two is Asian vegetarian.
How personalized could the meals actually get?
We do have a full segment of invitation only. We do have our platinum members who are regular travelers on board. And in some cases, we have personal relationships with these passengers because they regularly order the same thing because they have their favorites and we actually personalize the delivery. There's a passenger who would ask for macadamia nuts in their nut bowl for their drinks. We will provide it to them. So we do personalize as much as we can. There are requests that come ad hoc where a passenger has a very special condition and would like to have a special meal delivered to them. And we do them. We customize packages all the time.
But what about the future? For those of us sitting en masse at the back of the plane, could I ever get to the point where I could be, don't really like mushrooms?
Yes, I'm sure in the future we are looking at different avenues where we can actually customize a menu. But at this moment, of course, we have a menu which is available to you online. You can actually view when you're booking your flight to be able to see what is being offered on the menu.
How's Instagram and the rise of social media changing the way you provide food? People taking airplane food selfies, all of the food rating websites. Are you under pressure to make it look nicer for the camera?
It's funny you just asked. We actually went through a complete menu design process just about a couple of weeks back, and we were discussing this. We've always done this from the beginning. We've always made the product as beautiful as possible, making sure it's still authentic. We will not change the appearance of the product just to make it beautiful. If a biryani is with rice covered, it's just not our way to make sure that something else is sticking out so it's Instagrammable. We make it authentic as possible. It has to be what it is when the passenger receives it.
How do you know what it tastes like at 30,000 feet? Are you going up there and tasting all the meals at altitude?
We do. We are regularly tasked with traveling to our regional remits to make sure that we are designing the product on the other end too. During that time, we actually do an entire review. We are not the only ones doing the review too. We have mystery shoppers, we have customer experience inspectors, we have product purses, we have a slew of staff who are actually regularly traveling. Not only them, we are actually getting our feedback live from our passengers on a daily basis. As we sit right now, I probably have 60 KISS reports just flying in this minute.
KISS reports?
These are our knowledge information system. This is what we actually term our feedback system. If there's one passenger who says something different about a particular meal, we come right away, we check it out. If we are not physically available in that city, we will get the chefs to look at it. They try it to make sure that it's 100% what it's supposed to be before it's actually delivered again.
Do you stealth fly on other airlines to see what they're serving?
Not my role, but there is a department, I'm sure. And then there are passengers. We are often in situations where we are actually flying a city which is not serviced by Emirates. And we are very curious at that time. We will look at what they serve.
And that is Ravi Nage, who is the Regional Catering Manager at Emirates. The Business Breakfast Nightcap. On Dubai Eye 103.8. Good evening, I'm Brandy Scott. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Because Dubai taking another step to become more of a cultural hub. Is this a business story? We debated fiercely last night and in the early hours of this morning, and we have decided unequivocally yes.
His Highness Sheikh Mohammed on Twitter says, "We have adopted the first long-term cultural visas for artists. It is all part of a new cultural vision for Dubai. Al-Khoz is being turned into a cultural free zone." So the reasons that I've come down on thinking, yes, this is a significant business story are two or threefold. And the first one is research not from the United Arab Emirates, but from the United States that shows us just how big a part of the economy it is. It's 4.3% of the US economy, about $804 billion. They bracket arts and culture together. So it's not the be-all and end-all, but it is a significantly small part of the economy. And on a number of different levels, in and of itself, it's a job creator, but it's also a driver of tourism. I was talking yesterday with Hani Asfour. He's the Dean of the Dubai Institute of Design and Innovation. I happen to be down in Dubai Design District, and I thought, well, let's get Hani's take on this. And he says culture is important for these reasons.
If you think about it, you'll find that anytime you visit a new city or a country, what you look for are the cultural icons. And what you enjoy are the cultural events and cultural effects that this society has to produce. So I would say that the art, the architecture, the public spaces, the culinary food, and all of those things, this is how you measure culture. And if you notice, the more civilized society is, the more advanced their culture is and more memorable.
And Hani says that is beginning to happen in Dubai.
Dubai is going through that now. If you look at Dubai has a very rich history. And today what we are doing, we're building on that history to create a differentiated and unprecedented urban culture, which is Dubai, and everyone wants to be here. So I feel very strongly that culture is a driver of civilization and is a driver of innovation, because there's a lot of room for societies and culture to continue to improve and build on their history.
Now, you might not know this, but Malavika Vardhan from down the hall here, City Station, City 101.6, one of our sister stations, has a little bit of a side hustle going on. Malavika is also the managing director of The Hive, which is a performing arts space in JLT. So she is one of the people who's woken up this morning and got quite excited about this news, and she's told us why this announcement is important to her.
I'm thrilled, honestly. I couldn't be happier, because I feel like this is the step that so many artists in Dubai have been waiting for so many years and decades. You know, being an artist, being a dancer or being a singer or being a director or an actor is a full-time profession. It requires everything you have. But up until now, you know, full-time artists have had to have other full-time jobs that allow them to do this, or have had to work with very limited number of companies actually creating art in the city, right? So I feel like finally this is going to mean that Dubai becomes a true cultural hub, and that we invite artists from around the world to come here and create. And we really are at the center of the world, so why not? And I can't wait for The Hive to be a part of this new journey and this new story that Dubai wants to tell.
So she makes a really important point to me, which is Rich, you are absolutely right in that there are globally GDP numbers which will show that, you know, there is a boost from arts to GDP. There's certainly a boost to tourism. I've looked at some numbers this morning suggesting that there's a boost to house prices in areas that have either public art or art galleries. But what Malavika is saying there is effectively that it means that artists can live here without having to get another day job in order to get a visa to be here, which is interesting indeed. So if you're in a financial position to make your art, your writing, your singing, your dancing, whatever it happens to be, a full-time job, and that's a whole nother kettle of fish and a whole nother story as well, then you can sort out your residency an awful lot easier to do this just as your main gig. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow morning with fresh content, news stories. It's all going on 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.